Now, you and I, we both love C.S. Lewis. And you remember Lewis says something about you may get to a point in your life when you're grown up enough to understand a fairy tale.
Why do we care? Which we do. Why do we care about stories? Why do we tell these stories? Even the idea of myth is so fascinating because we can tell stories, but the depth of some of these folk tales, these myths, it seems otherworldly.
Yeah.
Where do you suppose that comes from?
Storytelling and myth is about symbols. It is about metaphors. It isn't about getting to the point necessarily. But you can imagine for my Christian family, they speak a slightly different tone. And they're like, are you telling us you have become a Christian? Is that clear enough for you? And so then I had to say, do you know what? The reality is I haven't become a Christian. I've realized I was probably a Christian all along, just a very, very dreadful example of one. As we say in Orthodoxy, of all sinners, I am the first.
Well, don't stop. Thank you. Wow, we have to sit. I have to speak sitting. Martin, pretend you're not here because I'm going to introduce you.
I can't hear a word.
I wanted you to come in dramatically. My goodness. My name is Eric Metaxas. I'm the host of Socrates in the City. And I am so excited about this conversation, but I don't want to tell you about that. I just want you to experience it. So I should ask up front as well, how many of you are familiar with Martin Shaw? So a lot of you, a lot of the bearded men, I've noticed. That's very interesting. And I'm so embarrassed. I usually have, if you know me, I just have a huge beard. I shaved it today without even thinking, and I feel so stupid. Tonight, I could have shaved
even
it tomorrow.
The fellow behind us has a beard.
Yes, that's right.
There's a dress code, you know?
And ironically, they just painted that on yesterday. He was clean shaven just yesterday. Well, anyway, I feel very embarrassed to be clean shaven, but there it is. What can you do? Well, for those of you who aren't that familiar with Martin Shaw, let me tell you just a little bit about him. And he's right here in case you're wondering what he looks like. Martin Shaw is a writer, mythographer, that's not a real thing, by the way, and Christian thinker, actually just a thinker. He's a visiting scholar at the Divinity Faculty of Cambridge University and a fellow of the Temenos Academy, author of 17 books. And I was going to say earlier, bizarrely, that's what we have in common. I'm the author of 17 books. I'm not making that up. That's true. Kind of weird. He's the director of the West Country School of Myth and founder of the Oral Tradition and Mythic Life courses at Stanford University. His book, Bard's Skull, was described as rich and transgressive in the Sunday Times, which we don't read in America. And it was book of the day in The Guardian, which we spit on. He's a hugely respected...
I knew this was coming.
I know. He's a hugely respected oral story teller. He's toured internationally many times, led symposiums at Oxford and Cambridge. And Robert Bly has described him as a true master, one of the very greatest storytellers we have. That, to me, is a big deal. And so it is my privilege to be here tonight at Socrates in the City with Martin Shaw. Martin, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For coming.
Hello.
I read your book this week.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I did.
It's helpful.
Because it's it's funny talking to an author as an author sometimes because it's writing a book is a big deal. And your book in particular, the kind of book that it is. But before we leap into it, and I have it here, of course, and I want to leap into it, tell us a little bit about yourself, because what I often have said with Socrates in the City is we talk about, you know, I like to talk about the meaning of life. You know, this is a small subject, the meaning of life. But then the question previous to what's the meaning of life is, why should we expect life to have meaning? What is the meaning of meaning? Why is it that people think, I want to know what the meaning of life is? Because there are some people, I think, who would suggest that life has no meaning, or they would say oh, it's what we make of it, or whatever that means. But you seem to have in your life for decades been interested in the meaning of life. And how did you begin that process? What was it about your life that led you to the path that you began, I don't know, say 30 years ago?
Great question. It's interesting. This is a thought I've only had recently, and it's an odd thought for a storyteller, that we might finally have reached a moment in history where we are on the receiving end of too many stories. Too many stories. When my phone announces itself at 7 o'clock in the morning, there's one seduction technique after another, trying to convince me of something or other. So the wonderful thing about my childhood, which is where the question, I think, begins.
Feel free to sit back. Yeah, and no, if you want to smoke a pipe.
Cigar.
A cigar. We would.
Got to be a cigar. Yeah. I look odd with a pipe. You'd think it would work.
You look odd without a pipe.
Well, here we go. Moving swiftly on. So I was born in 1971, and I was born in a very rich house culturally, but we didn't have any cash as such. So we wouldn't have had a car, we wouldn't have had a telephone, we wouldn't have had a television. And I'd have loved all of those things, but we didn't have them. What we had was books. And I had a mum and a dad, who mercifully I still have, who were just in love with language. They thought speech was wealth, in a way. And so I grew up around the great stories. I grew up around the Arthurian tradition and Irish stories and Russian folk tales, all sorts of things. And it's
interesting. You thought that was normal?
Yeah, I did. But
it's not.
To be fair, I felt at the time a little shy about it. I felt that I was unduly limited. But of course, it's weird, isn't it? You get involved in life. You go through certain duress and disasters that arrive perfectly on time. And then you remember those tales you loved as a kid. And you hear them with a completely different resonance when you've suffered a bit. And so really what happened was, in my 20s, because, I mean, you were just saying quite rightly, like, where does the word mythographer come from? Is that even a word? Well, I would have had no clue as to what I'm doing now could have sort of existed in the world. The nearest I would have got to that would be, it's a particular women that I love, women who work in libraries and read stories for children. God bless those women. That was a kind of magic at the end of the day when I was at school, when I knew that was going to happen. Now, reading a story is one thing, but actually telling it, dare to imagine out loud in an unscripted, unrecital form, that is a level of chutzpah that I'd never really seen until I came across a fella that you actually mentioned a few minutes ago, the great Minnesotan poet and storyteller Robert Bly. And he was a sort of cultural tornado at the time. And he was in love with these tiny little folk tales that he could expand as a kind of yoga of the imagination. They were up there with, you know, the great philosophical thoughts. They were up there with Homer. And so gradually, luckily, into my life came people that were brilliant teachers and could unpick the genius of a fairy tale. Now, you and I, we both love C.S. Lewis. And you remember Lewis says something about, you may get to a point in your life when you're grown up enough to understand a fairy tale. Well, somehow, because I have no plan B, that's what helps. There's no plan B. There's nothing I can do. I don't understand the mechanics of a car. I'm not going to be a lawyer anytime soon. So I was always pushed into this beautiful, befuddled, mythopoetic world. That's what I know about.
And how did it begin for you? In other words, if you're in your 20s,
yeah.
You know, you can't say, well, I'd like to be a mythographer. How do I start? Or how did it begin for you?
Well, okay, so hold on, because the story is about to go out where the buses don't park. Because when I was really young, I was a rock and roll musician. And that was a wonderful thing in its way. But I became disillusioned with it. And I also have terrible tinnitus. So as I'm sitting here with you, That's what's going on all the time in my head. So I can hear this shrieking sound. So that retires you from being a rock drummer. But because I had grown up with these old fairy tales, I knew about the tradition of a storyteller. Now, as an Anglo-Irish mutt, which I am, the word you would use is shanachie. A shanachie is a storyteller, but they're not... It's not stories for kids, necessarily.
I saw the word and I didn't dare pronounce it. Shanachie?
Shanachie. Yeah, you did it. Perfect.
Now that I've heard you say it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the highfalutin way of describing what a shanachie is a cultural historian of a place. So in other words, you could draw a square, you could draw a circle of around 10 miles where you live, and you could say, I will study the gossip of the hedgerows, the movement of animals, the folk tales, the stories, everything that comes from this little district, and I will be a repository of information about it. And for some reason, I found that so attractive that when I was 26, I did something very odd. I disappeared entirely from polite society. Some of you remember the 20th century. We could get away with things like this back in the day. And I took myself out into the wilds of England. And believe it or not, I lived in a tent for 4 years. Now, just as to be absolutely clear, this is not the kind of tent you get in a camping shop. This is a gorgeous Mongolian tent. Have you ever seen the film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon? It's got that kind of exuberance to it.
Where does a 20-something-year-old get a gorgeous Mongolian tent?
You have to know a fella called Nick Twilley.
Uh-huh.
And if you know Nick, Nick will sort it out for you. Because I wouldn't have been able to make it, you see. Again, no plan B. I have no carpentry skills. But this is the important bit about this time out in the... in the bush, we would call it. I would have lit about 1,000 fires in that tent because we had a little wood-burning stove. And the thing I decided to do was that every time I lit a fire, I would learn a folktale. And so if I lit 1,000 fires, I would have learned 1,000 stories. I didn't really tell them to anybody at the time because I was so crippled with, you know, shyness, actually, and all of that. And I thought I'd have been terrible and I hated my voice. But it got to about fire number 670, and I invited a couple of friends round, and I gave them a drink called Hangman's Blood. I'm going to give you the recipe right now.
We're going to demand the recipe.
Eric, this is for you. 4 pints of Guinness into a pot, 1 bottle of brandy, 1 bottle of port, stirred with a red-hot poker in a tent as it's snowing. You will have been wafted aloft at that point, I tell you.
So stir with a red hot poker.
Stir with a red hot poker. You get the hangman's blood going, and then when everybody was suitably subdued, I began to tell a story.
Yeah.
And now I thought everyone had fallen asleep, but I continued on, and then out of the darkness, my dear old pal Gavin. Now in England, you have to understand what I'm saying. In England, what he says is. This is superlative praise. He said, that was quite good. Now, for us, you know, we feed on that for months. And so Gavin, in a way, seeded the notion in my head that actually this was a universe where language actually mattered and stories reached out and touched it. They reached out and touch the intelligence of a cormorant or a forest or the movement of a river. And this is the old tradition of storytelling that actually, and here's a strange idea, but it's a lovely one, the earth thinks in myth. So when you go for a walk, maybe you've got a dog or an animal or you're going camping, in some very strange way, there's lots of things we're going through at the moment in our private lives, in the political sphere. In a strange way, if you can't tell it as a story, I don't know how deep you can actually get into it. I've been thinking recently about it's a Mexican phrase, the river beneath the river. And there comes a point in your life where the facts of the matter are not telling you the story of the matter. They're not announcing anything. So in a rather jumbled way, I took myself off to the periphery of polite society and then beyond that. And I just accumulated an enormous amount of stories. But I knew I had to find a way back in. And the way I found a way back in was actually by doing something very different. I did a PhD. So I took
that
all
sounds
of,
like a punchline.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, on some level, it's just very funny that you, you're in a Mongolian tent.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong. You're in a Mongolian tent, and every night you make a fire and you learn a folk tale. You understand that's not normal.
I do.
And most of us here, I would say 2/3 of us have not done that.
I see the third.
So it's a very...
I see you.
So it's a very... I'm fascinated with the idea that you did that. And you must realize that, I mean, I would see it as God makes each of us differently. And that you were clearly made to do this because other people just don't do that. But you had a sense that this is normal or this is good or this is valuable.
I knew it wasn't normal. I knew it wasn't. I did have a cat. A cat was a major thing. I reflect on it now with a lot of love for that kid, because it's a bold move. It's a bold move. All my friends went off and had careers and children immediately and things like that. So sometimes it is hard for me to find my way back. And if I could show that kid now this.
Yeah.
Because I didn't do it for any... There was no career to be had.
Okay, here's the question.
There was no work to be done from it.
Were your parents... What were your parents thinking?
Because
if I had a son who did that, I'd kill him.
Yeah, yeah. Mercifully, you're not my father.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't actually kill him. I think, because listen, now you're a parent, I'm a parent, and we love our kids so much. We care so much. So if your son goes off into the woods and is doing this kind of thing, did they have a sense that this was okay?
Do you remember, if you've been to England, probably most, have you ever seen a red phone box?
Yeah.
Those old kind of phone boxes. The deal with my parents was ring us at least once every couple of weeks. So I'd come out of the woods, I'd find a phone box, and this is when you put cash in, you know, coins, and I'd talk to them. And my mum and dad are wild romantics, really. And I think they knew from the moment I think my mum certainly knew from the moment I popped out. She said, he's going to be a funny one, you know, so let's keep her. So and they have profound faith. And I think they intuited that there was never a moment that I had turned from the grace, that in some rather aboriginal way, I was trying to figure out how to become a real human being. And that was what I was trying to do.
What a beautiful way to put it. You should be a writer. Have you thought of it? Think about it. Don't give me an answer, but think about it. I found it funny when you said, so then I thought, well, how do I get out of this? I'll get a PhD. And yet, that makes perfect sense. If you've been studying folk tales, and as I mentioned to you earlier, I love folk tales and folklore. And for many, many years, when I was in my 20s, I was majoring in that. So it is interesting that you went and you said, I want to get a PhD. In other words, I want to actually study this officially somehow.
Yeah, I mean, when your only audience has been the cat and the wood burner and the valley, outside, I thought maybe I should, I need to experience some resistance because I need to work on my ideas. I need to work on what the ideas are. That's another form of thinking. Now, what actually happened, and I don't think I've ever spoken of this publicly, I didn't even have an email, didn't have a computer or anything, but I found out at a local college there was an art historian, there was a woman who was, she was partially American, part Lakota Sioux. And I wrote to her on Easter Day, and I said, I have this idea. I don't know if anything could come of it. And I know a fella called Wallace Black Elk. Would you know Wallace Black Elk? Poof, off it goes. About 15 minutes later, she says, come in tomorrow, I'm bringing the dean. And suddenly, in this moment of extraordinary sort of serendipity, I had two really wise women sitting with me saying, there's a ghost of an idea in what you're thinking about, and we'll help you tug on that thread, but in a way that doesn't damage and thin out what you're bringing to these conversations. So I was just very, people dropped at just the right time. But even all the way through the doctorate, people said, you know, this is the most useless PhD of all time, and there will be no gainful employment for you, right. Master Shaw. And then on the day of my viva, my oral defence, which lasted for many hours, they said, well, what are you going to do now? What are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm a professor at Stanford. Bye. And I got the gig at Stanford. So I was suddenly, I have to be honest, and I love the country that I come from, but there has been, oddly, there's been an ease in America. There's been a receptivity that I never could have anticipated. So suddenly I was in a really phenomenal university.
Well, so at the heart, I mean, I was mentioning it with regard to Socrates in the City. It's interesting to me that you were interested in these things, in ideas and meaning. And yeah. It is fascinating. I mean, if you wanted to, you know, just talk about what does it mean to be a human being?
Yeah.
Why do we care, which we do, why do we care about stories? Why do we tell these stories? Even the idea of myth is so fascinating because we can tell stories, but the depth of some of these folk tales, these myths, it seems otherworldly.
Yeah.
Where do you suppose that comes from?
The traditional response to why we create these stories is that thousands of years ago, we sat here in a very, very uncertain world, and a combination of anxiety and imagination sort of puzzled them into being. I find that a bit unsexy, to be honest. I can't hang my heart on stories arriving just from neurosis. I'm just not a fan of that. And because I'm a Christian, I would be interested in what the Irish philosopher John Moriarty calls divine ground. So in other words, it's Augustine, all truth is God's truth. In these myths, there are these little pinpricks of something quite wonderful coming on, these little pinpricks of eternity. And I was thinking about Bruce Springsteen. Bruce said something a few years ago that I've thought about over and over again. They said, he was honest that he suffered from depression. And they said, how can you possibly be suffering from depression? How can that be happening to you? And he said, well, why do you think I play 4 hours a night? Because I don't want it to stop. Mm. But then he said this. He said, the money and the wealth and the fame, he said, it makes life easier, but it hasn't made living easier. Hmm. And I thought, wow. And for me, somewhere in that, there's an old Irish belief that as you're growing, you need to be, it's the image they use is beautiful, is you need to have a swan feather cloak of stories around you. And if you don't have those stories in your bones, you're almost missing a skin. You're almost missing a skin. And as you get older, and you try on various personas, as we all do, which I think is important when you're younger. But when you get older, you're going to become much more interested in the notion of presence, not persona, presence. We only have a few years, you know? Presence, what does that look like? Well, the stories, I think, in their irascible genius, in their wild genius, they push us into becoming, as I said, I'm sorry, I'm repeating the phrase, real human beings. That's what the book is about. Now, what a real human being is, that's another conversation, you know.
Well, I mean, it's always the conversation. It's like the river beneath the river. It's the conversation beneath the conversation.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
What else should we care about? What does it mean to be a human being? And what are we looking to get out of this human being thing? Now, the book, to sort of pivot, Liturgies of the Wild. Now, everyone here gets a copy of it. It, no charge. Now, we say that, but we expect a lot from you. I just want you to know. You'll wish you had paid for it, I think. But I really did spend this week reading this, and there's so much. I kind of don't know where to begin, but maybe we can begin. Tell us your story of the 101-day vigil in the Dartmoor Forest. And all of us who live in New York, we're jealous that you get to say things like, you know, you did a 101-day vigil in a Dartmoor forest. We don't have, you know, we all live like next door to a CVS. It's not as magical here. But tell us a little bit about this vigil. First of all, why were you doing a 101-day vigil?
Cities have their charisma. I was thinking this in the taxi. I will get round to this. I was in a taxi with an old Greek storyteller today.
It's
beautiful, beautiful fellow, because we were in gridlock trying to get here. And he said, I came here in the 50s.
You got a Greek taxi driver?
Is this unusual?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, this was a great raconteur. If you become a storyteller, you attract these kind of characters. They know they can unburden. So anyway, I just want to tell you this beautiful story about this fella, because he took me through Hell's Kitchen, and he said, "Sir, Hell's, I was here in the 50s, and the Irish folk, you know, which would be my people, you know, they had a certain stranglehold at certain points, but he was too poor to go back to Greece for 45 years after he left. And for the last few years, he just had enough money, chokes me up as a taxi driver, to go back for 3 months a year. And he said, I just decided today I am going home. I'm going home. And so I had my hand on his shoulder, because I go to Crete and I tell the Odyssey for 5 days. And so I just said, you know, you are the man of twists and turns. You are brave Odysseus, and you are heading back to Ithaca. So I just want to give that.
I think he's making this up. Come on. What are the odds?
I give that
Come
to
on.
New York. I'll tell you the other thing.
I'm just jealous because I am Greek.
Yeah, yeah.
And every time, maybe once a year, and I take a lot of taxis,
yeah,
I'll get a Greek taxi driver. So I just want to say I'm jealous.
Yeah.
George. And my family, well, we George. Knew his name was George or Nick.
Yeah.
But my family in Greece is from Kefalonia, which is next to Ithaca.
Okay,
and so all of this means a lot. When you talk about the Odyssey, all of this means a tremendous amount to me.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in case they don't know, Greek people, we invented stories. So but for you to, well, forgive me, please keep going, because I do want you at some point to talk about the Dartmoor vigil.
So this is what Dartmoor is. It's 365 square miles of wilderness. That's what it is. It is a national park. I'm very lucky to have grown up in and around the park. We don't have a lot of forest, but there is an old 500-acre growth called Holmchase. Now, it was around the time of about very early 2020, so we're about to hit lockdown, but we don't know. By now, I am approaching my 50th birthday. I have been through times of mild success, extreme duress. I have had the joy of being a father. I have had some kind of piratical academic career. I've had the joy of teaching for years, writing books. But it's interesting, Eric. I began to feel a little bit of distance between the lad that went out in the tent all those years ago. And I thought, I don't need to replicate that experience exactly, but I need to extend in that direction again. So what the vigil meant was, it's not as highfalutin as it sounds. Every day I went into the forest for about 2 hours, usually at dusk, and I sat and I sat and I sat, in the way that early Christians actually in Ireland would have done. I just sat because I was so totally bored with myself. I was just uninterested. And there was the beginning when I was teaching of a flatness coming in, a sense of being reheating the meal. And I thought, I know, I will push myself, because 101 days, who wants to do anything 101 times? You might want to do it 6 or 10, but I thought 101 days will be a test of my fidelity, not just my emotional state. So because I knew 101 stories, I went out. No one knew I was doing this, not even my daughter. I'd just slip away. For 101 days, I told stories to that place. just as a thank you, I love forests and I love animals and I love stags and I love foxes, comes to the last night.
But wait, hold on.
I've given you gold.
Hang on a tick. hang on a tick, as they say in New York. You told stories out loud.
Yeah.
To the place,
yeah.
Well, now...
How would that be?
I don't think that's a bad thing.
No.
But I've never done that. So can you... you don't have to get into it deeply, but why would you do that? That's a fascinating thing.
Why would I do that? Well, when I lived in my tent, I had time on my hands. And so I developed this very peculiar little practice where I would go for a walk, and if I found something that I admired, I would look at it in a variety of ways, and I'd give it 12 secret names. 12 secret names. Try this with your wife or your husband. The next time you think, I'm so sick of them, just take a breath, and you'll find a bit of magic again. You'll find a bit. So I am following the question. So I was used to, when I was learning a story, because there was no one around me, no one was living in the tent with me, willing me on, I had no choice, as I think about it now, but to walk along, to walk the story into my bones. I'd just talk out loud. Preachers do it all the time. I'd seen my dad doing it, in fact. So I think it was just, I didn't even overthink it. But I did feel, as you get in these old stories, and certainly in indigenous cultures, that in some way the place seemed to like it. So I thought, as a giving back to something that I had received so much from, I was just going to do this rather bewildering thing. So
it seems to me a kind of a form, in some ways, of meditation, that there's something happening as you're doing that. I mean, because you're doing it not just for the place, but also for yourself. There's something happening as you go through this, but you're not, you had no conscious intention of what that would be. You just thought it would be valuable.
I couldn't tell. I'd never known anybody that had done this. So I thought, I'd no idea what'll happen at the end of 101 days. But there's an old idea that you get that the soul doesn't live entirely in your body. So in other words, us in the West, we tend to sort of point here in some general direction. Here is the soul. But in many of the stories and the cultures that I really love, the soul is partially in you, but it's partially out there with the rivers and the animals and the mountains and the stars. You know, I think of Abraham being taken out of the tent by God and saying, look at this, look at this, look at this. There's some kind of connection that I felt. I think I felt I was beginning to lose it. I suspect I was becoming a little domestic, and I wanted to shake the domesticity off, but I had no idea where it was going to lead. It's the final night. I'm so desperate for this to stop now. 101 days. I'd peaked on day 18, but I'd carried on. Now, in the centre of the forest, there is an Iron Age fort. It's an old Iron Age fort. And I knew...
Iron Age fort?
Yes, like an old... have you heard of the Iron Age?
We don't have that here.
Well, you'd be familiar with the Bronze Age, the Iron Age, the Stone Age. There's a few of you have copped onto this.
Yeah.
So the Iron Age fort, which I knew had the bones, it's absolutely riddled with the bones of the dead, but I thought, that's where I'll go for the final night. And I must say, just to clarify what happens next, I hadn't been fasting. I'd had a meal before I went up there. I'd had a cup of tea. It was simply to bring an end, you know, a bow on this experience. I felt filled with gratitude. I felt very peaceful. But as I was there, an odd thought came into my mind. I thought, you know, you've been telling a lot of stories, but you should pray now. You should pray. Sometimes stories are prayers, but I had a desire to drop everything and pray. And I didn't really know, if I'm absolutely honest, who or what I was praying to. But this is what I said, something like this, if I can remember. You know, here I am. Here I am in all my befuddled brokenness. just a little fella in the woods. I don't even quite know why I'm here. But if there's anything I need to know or see, I'm absolutely open to that right now. When you're in a very dark forest, you hear animals move. So your attention is always around you like this because there's the movement of a stag or a fox. But I did something I have never done before. And I don't know why I did it. I looked up. I didn't look down. I looked up. And I was suddenly aware of how many breathtaking pale blue stars were in the night sky. It was gorgeous. And then this really weird thing happens. It took about 30 seconds. I looked up and I saw one particular star seem to drop. It was like you've seen a shooting star. It was a bit like that. But as it fell, it began to change its colour. And it was a bit like, I've never seen it, but some of you will, the Aurora Borealis, those beautiful golds and pinks and whites. And as I stared at this star, it just fell out of the sky. And it began to look, just like you're seeing it from a distance, and it began to take the shape, really, of the tip of an arrow, a beautiful painted arrow, really. And I watch it, and I think, bloody hell, that's getting close. And it just fell into the ground about as near as that fella. It wasn't frightening. And the interesting thing was there was no sound. There was no sound. I didn't know what was going on. What is ironic years later is I remember thinking, this reminds me of something from the Old Testament. But that was as far as it went. I jogged from foot to stay warm for the rest of the night. The temperature was much like it was now. But I was shaking with shock that something as real. I was not in an altered state when this happened. I was not a Sufi dancer. I hadn't been sun dancing for days. This just it happened like this glass of water is happening. It just happened to me. But the important thing is the context in which it happened. I wouldn't mind at all if a scientist wrote to me and said, actually, I found out that on January the 23rd, this fellow, it wouldn't bother me in the least. When I got back to the cottage, I was getting into bed, thinking like, okay, that is enough. Can this now stop? You know, have I been spiked or something? Can this stop? I very briefly saw 9 words in front of me, which I will be puzzling about forever. It said, inhabit the time and genesis of your original home.
Inhabit the time
and genesis.
And genesis.
Of your original home.
Of your original home.
Yeah.
Now, when you say you saw those words,
yeah, I did.
What do you mean?
What I mean is, I think I'd got into bed. I'd have been absolutely knackered, as we would say. And I probably closed my eyes. And it was as my eyes closed, I saw them in front of me. What I remember is the colour. They were like gold. It was like pale gold. And I just thought, oh, not Genesis. Not bloody Genesis. Please, please. And then it's lockdown. So I have 18 months alone in the cottage to ruminate on what had just happened. And still I had to be dragged reluctantly to the feast. Still, I didn't want to fess up to what was happening. And it was only as we got right to my 50th birthday, I had a series of dreams, which mercifully are in the book, and I do not need to repeat now. But suddenly, there's a lovely phrase, the indwelling presence. And I suddenly realised that the presence, the thing I'd longed for my whole life, actually, was closer to me than my own breath. And if you are lucky enough, if you're lucky enough to get to the middle of your life and you glimpse something like that, don't let a chance like that go by. You can't. It's a foolishness. Now, what happened to me afterwards is I learned something very important about human nature. People love you when you're looking for something and they absolutely hate it when you find it. So things got difficult after that.
Now, when you say that, you have to be more explicit about what it was that you found.
Well, I found my way It's an interesting phrase that I've used, and maybe it's a naive one, but it was as if somewhere in the forest I experienced the mossy face of Christ, the sheer strangeness of the Galilee Druid. He's not at all what I thought he was. Born an outcast, or born a fugitive, dies an outlaw, has the audacity to come back. This is the strangest of the gods. This is the strangest, and I've studied them all. This is different. And I think I was frightened of him when I was growing up, because the ask was so huge and so different to a werewolf. Do you know what? If I'm honest, he seems so feminine.
To a werewolf?
It wasn't obviously heroic in a way that an 8-year-old could understand. The Beatitudes, the last shall be first. I couldn't get my head around that in the rugby team at school when I'm very physical and I'm filled with ambition. So, for whatever reason, it seems as if I needed to learn a whole succession of different languages when I was growing up than had I stayed in the Baptist church that I grew up in. And then suddenly, for whatever reason, at 50, now, that's what happened. So I rang my parents. Can you imagine? They've been holding the other end of this thread for 30 years. For 30 years, Rob and Sal have been praying for their lad. So I was able to ring them. That's what happened.
Now, you're speaking in some ways very obliquely. It's one thing to say that you saw the mossy face of Christ.
Yeah.
It's another thing to say that I accept whatever that means. What did it mean to you? In other words, were you immediately hostile, and then there was a process, or how did that work for you? Because you don't seem to have been hostile to Christianity,
no,
but just existing apart from it somehow.
Yeah.
What happened in that night, in that season?
I was and remain an unapologetic romantic. That is how I am wired. When they throw me in the clay on my 301st birthday, they'll say, there goes that romantic. So I had a fuzzy sense of God. Do you know when Paul is in Greece and he says, you know, I'll tell you about the unknown God. Well, I followed an unknown God. Now, what does that mean? It means that I loved beauty and I loved music and I loved all of that stuff. But when I had to make a decision of quiet moral cowardice, I could, because I'd never really pinned it to a particular thing. I'd stayed suitably, you know, tacit, not explicit. So it's a hard thing to gather the words, you know, and especially, I mean, it's storytelling and myth is about symbols. It is about metaphors. It isn't about getting to the point necessarily, but you can imagine for my Christian family, they speak a slightly different tone. And they're like, are you telling us you have become a Christian? Is that clear enough for you? And so then I had to say, do you know what? The reality is I haven't become a Christian. I've realized I was probably a Christian all along. Just a very, very dreadful example of one. As we say in Orthodoxy, of all sinners, I am the first.
That's the only way to fly. Well, so what did you do then? What did you feel an obligation to do? Suddenly this... Well, first of all, what a gift. What an outrageous gift, because, you know, most of us don't do these 101-day vigils to begin with.
Do it.
And then... but at the end of it, to have this vision, which really not a vision, I don't know what you call it, a sign from God, an amazing sign from God, a startling sign from God. And then to get those words, this is a gift. I mean, I've had a number of mystical experiences in my life. It's an outrageous gift. And
it is.
You, so how did you respond?
I think that was my Star Over Bethlehem moment. I don't think I'm going to get another one. It would be greedy. The trouble, actually, this is when the rubber hits the road, because I have not remained in an ecstatic state for 5 years. There's been all sorts of ups and downs since then. And the real problem, actually, was I thought, oh, please don't tell me I have to go to a church. Please don't tell me I have to go to a church.
You have to go to a church.
Yeah. Thank you, Eric, for supplying that. I did believe that, actually. So this is what happens next, is I think, okay, well, I knew that there's something, I think, intrinsically healthy about try the church literally nearest to your house. Like, just do that. Be have a zip code, you know, go somewhere. And I went to a lovely Anglican place, and that was very nice, and the people were extremely nice, and that was all right. And then I went up the road to a Catholic place, and I have a lot of Catholic friends. But I remember the priest saying, and now it was Pentecost, and he did this thing with his finger.
He did the scare quotes around Pentecost.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was like tongues of fire, and I was off because I couldn't be doing with that. Then I went to the.
You didn't like the mockery?
No,
the
I didn't.
Sarcasm?
It was. You know what he was? He was. It's the word that people love. He was a bane, and I thought I'd a bane. You know, there's a bit of sulfur in the air actually, so I was off. Then I went to the Baptists. Now, the Baptists were really interesting because what they have in their pocket is, you know, that tremendously sort of intimate sense that you can speak directly to God. He has your undivided attention. And to be in that Baptist church with fellas that had just come off the building site and they've got mud on their boots and they've got a kid hanging off them and they've got their arms open like that, that is tremendously moving. And I would never throw those people under the bus. But still, there was something I was looking for in my contemplative heart that I still couldn't find until one Sunday, I was wandering through a shopping mall. Have you ever been to the Mall of America? Minneapolis, I think. If ever it feels like a godless environment, that's it. But I'm in the middle of this mall, and there's this one building they just could not knock down. It's an old Anglo-Saxon building. It's in a town called Exeter. And I knew it was Sunday, and I thought, well, I've tried everything else. I'll wander in and see what's happening. And I walk through the door, and I enter something called Divine Liturgy. It's Eastern Orthodox Divine Liturgy. It's in the Russian tradition. And I just don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. It was electrifying. And it was just as nourishing and strange as the forest. Now, that I'd never been able to find, you see. I'd never find something. This is beautiful. I love being in this room, but I'm not trading it for the bush, you know. But this thing, the Divine Liturgy, for the first time in my life, I experienced a religious ceremony with other people that really felt like it was a runway between heaven and earth. And it went on and on and on. And I did not sit down. And the priest seemed to have no interest in me whatsoever. There was no donuts. There was no coffee. There was no machines of any kind.
Surely there was some kind of espresso machine in the lobby.
Well, they brought that out later, but they kept it hid.
Because I was going to say, theologically, you know, that's necessary.
The interesting thing about the church is that it's about a third Ukrainians, third Russians, third English. That's an interesting combination politically, and we figure it out. Sometimes we have to have meetings and real things are said, and there's a lot of heart and a lot of tears. But this particular ceremony somehow overrides it. And so I was warned, if you go to five divine liturgies, you're probably in. But it was as if, this is an odd description, in that experience I had of the liturgy, it was as if a door opened out of this century altogether. And suddenly I could see Bethlehem. And beyond Bethlehem, you remember, oh yeah, it's all happening now. Before Abraham, I am. And so there's a Paleolithic Christ, and there's a Christ that is millions and millions of years old, and in some way that I'm not very doing a good job of describing, all of this was happening in this ceremony, to the point where I did something absolutely dreadful. I ran up to the front and took communion, and I was not a catechumen yet. I didn't know the rules. I was so absolutely a swoon with the whole thing. And because I looked like possibly I could be visiting from some distant, you know, distant diocese, they brought me in, did it, and then said, oh, my goodness, you're not Orthodox? And I said, well, I'd like to be. So then I entered that process, and that has been my home ever since.
I'm always fascinated by people's journeys, and because I was raised in the Greek Orthodox Church, yeah. And it's kind of a cliche of human life that whatever you have, you take for granted. Yeah. So I was raised in that, and didn't despise it, but neither did I appreciate it. And part of the reason I didn't appreciate it was a lot of it stunk, but the good part I didn't appreciate. But it's so fascinating how you come around and around and around, and then now I can appreciate it.
Yeah, I bet.
But it's what's interesting to me is that you grew up in the church. You said your father was a pastor.
Yeah, yeah.
And you got a lot of the explicit stuff, the
yes.
theology.
Yeah.
I didn't get any of that growing up in the Greek church, and I longed for that. And so I found that outside the Orthodox church, and I thought, this is so great. But over the decades now, just a year ago, we went to the Good Friday service in the church I grew up in Danbury, Connecticut. And it was like you're describing, it was otherworldly. It was symbolic, poetic. It wasn't words. It was another kind of reality. Mm. And it was so powerful. And I just thought, you know, the perfect church would have all of these things somehow combined. And it's the cliche. If you ever find the perfect church, don't join it because you'll spoil it, right? But it is what you're describing for those of us who are fatigued with enlightenment, rationalism, and theology. I know there's a place in the book where you say, in the beginning, I guess you're meeting with a priest weekly or something like that, and he said something to you like, Don't worry too much about the theology.
Yeah.
Worry about the presence. Talk a little bit about that, because I think some people worship theology. They don't worship God. They worship theology. And say something, if you would.
Yeah, I have a wonderful Father Porphyrius who took one look at me and knew that I was hot for books. He knew it. The moment he had me and me, he's like, you're one of those. So he said, cut out with the reading for a while. He said, kiss icons, copy. 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 And he said, watch what we do.
Oh.
The whole of the Divine Liturgy is a very, very slow form of movement. It's a dance, actually. Listen to how the feminine enters the Divine Liturgy through the singing. It's just so much of the feminine in there that people do not understand if they don't know what's actually happening. And so ours is a sung theology a lot of the time. It's absolutely extraordinary. Do you know what he did? At that point, there's a lovely woman who's a good singer, a lady called Dora. She was practically holding the whole choir up. And he said, stop reading the books, join the choir. And I was like, oh, God, really? And so I learnt liturgy by singing and singing and singing and singing. And so it's a very physical. And, these icons that are so wonderful, because we didn't all grow up in cultures where we could read. We didn't all grow up in cultures where we could read the Bible, but you can see an image and go, that is the road to Emmaus. I want to know about that. That's Peter jumping off the boat into the water when he sees Yeshua. So suddenly, as Lewis would say, my imagination is baptized because we're using all the sense and all the beauty and all the truth that we can muster.
I think sometimes in terms of, there's the Apollinean and the Dionysian, and we need both.
Yeah.
And some people love the Apollinean, some people love the Dionysian. Some years ago, I was going to, there's a church here in New York City, Redeemer Presbyterian Church, and very cerebral, and quotes from the New York Review of Books and all this kind of stuff, not very Dionysian. And then my wife and I were going to church, Times Square Church, which was incredible gospel worship and it felt very Dionysian. And I thought, we need both. And there are different times in our lives when we need more one than the other. But it's just a beautiful idea that you could experience, that you don't need to have a theology quiz.
No. Now, quoting somebody from the last century, some of you will remember a man who has an extraordinary achievement, Joe Campbell. And Joe Campbell always said this. He said, be terribly careful that you don't create a religion that defends you against a religious experience. And they also asked Campbell, they said, Mr. Campbell, what is your meditative practice? And he said, I underline things in books. And if we're talking of great teachers, think also of the great psychologist James Hillman. And James Hillman, and I say this to all my students, Hillman says, footnotes are how you honour your ancestors. Footnotes are how you honour your ancestors. So going back to what you asked me at the beginning is why do a doctorate after the forest experience in the tent? It's exactly that. It's those two things living in tension with each other. Negative capability, Keats used to call it.
You talk at some place in the book about... I'd never seen this before, so I was intrigued. You refer to Achilles in the Odyssey making a statement. I've read the Odyssey many times, and I pretend to be a descendant of Homer. I think I could prove it. But where Achilles in the underworld says, I'd sooner be a slave to a poor man than king of the underworld. And you make that sound like a prefigurement of the dawn of Christian faith.
Yeah.
Talk about that, because
I
never would have thought of that. It never occurred to me, and I never saw that in the Odyssey.
In Greek myth, see, this is the professor coming out now. In Greek myth, all the real pathos exists in humans, not the gods. Because the trouble with the gods is they can't bloody die, and it's miserable after a while. So in a story, when you want things to be really acute, you focus on human beings. Now, the interesting thing is what you get in the Iliad and the Odyssey and all of those stories is a love of something called kleos. Kleos means imperishable glory, that your reputation continues on after you've died. And kleos incarnate is Achilles. Achilles is it. So you remember years later when Odysseus is trying to get back to Ithaca, he has to go down into the underworld to talk to Tiresias, the milky-eyed seer. And he bumps into Achilles, who never liked him. He never liked Odysseus. And he says this thing.
Say it again, because I feel like I missed it. You said Odysseus goes to the underworld.
Yeah, he goes to talk to Tiresias. But he bumps into Achilles while he's there. It's like queuing for a bus.
Right.
He's like, oh, it's you. And Achilles doesn't like him. He never liked Odysseus. But he says this. Odysseus says in brief, he says, how's it working out for you down here? And this is when Achilles says this amazing thing. He says, sooner be a slave to a poor man than king of the underworld. And at that moment, I hear the last shall be first. I hear the bell of some other power announcing itself, and I think it happened in Homer. Now, the amazing thing, of course, about Jesus' life is that Jesus grew up very near the Silk Road. He could have heard the Odyssey. Isn't that extraordinary to think that little Yeshua sits there hearing the stories and going, wow, that's pretty far out, but I've got something too. So that's that bit.
I guess because you got a PhD in this stuff, I can ask you. That idea of Cleon, imperishable glory, and the idea that I'd rather be the slave to a poor man than king of the underworld. You're saying, I guess, that there isn't anything before that. This is the first glimpse we get in the West of that kind of thing outside of the Israel.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, you know, I'm not a specialist in lots and lots of different types of stories, so there'd always be somebody that could argue the convincingly. But for me, in that region at that time, you're hearing a very when you've got the great hero saying the thing that we've based everything on sucks once you've died. That's something to think about, and the fact that Homer keeps it in, that lives in the story as an energy from that point onwards. Yeah.
You mentioned, I don't think you mentioned it in the book. Maybe I was listening to a podcast today, where you were talking about the Russian Orthodox coming over the Bering Strait to Alaska, and how at first, rather than just chatting at the pagan Aleutians, they listened.
Yeah.
And you said that the natives, the Alaskans natives, had in their own mythology something like Christ.
Oh, yeah. By the way, if you have time on your hands, watch a film called Sacred Alaska. That's absolutely fantastic, and it'll just open up how nuanced and different the missionary approach is from Orthodoxy coming into Alaska. Rather than telling everybody what a bad job they've done, they said, tell us what is beautiful in your culture, and we will sit, and we will sit, and we will sit till you're done. And that, for me, that seems to be like grown-up behavior. We could pay attention to that. So,
but by the time they got to Canada, it didn't work. Canadians are very hard-hearted. Brutal people.
Brutal. Well, that's what I get every time I go to Canada. I just come out thinking those people. There's just no kindness in them. I love Canada. I can earn a living in Canada, actually. I'm not allowed to do that in America at the moment, but I can do it in Canada. But that is another story. So, you're also half hearing something else that comes from the beginning of the book. The first storyteller that I ever met was wasn't a Westerner. It was this Lakota Sioux fellow, Wallace Black Elk. I mentioned him briefly. Now, Wallace understood stories in a sort of pharmaceutical way. So in other words, if you were sick or ill, he'd say, well, which part of you is hurting? And you go, oh, it's my kidney. And you go, I've got a great story for your kidney. I've got a great story for your liver. You have a broken heart? I have a story for that. So I had this very elevated encounter as a young kid with a fella that was not reading stories out of a book, but using them medicinally almost. It's a very sophisticated technology that we can barely grasp over here. But that was interesting to me. But this is the strange thing about Wallace. Wallace was not a Christian, but he said something to me which was very disarming at the time. He said, you know the little hippie guy? And I was like, oh, I know who you mean. You know, the little hippie guy. And he said, we knew about him.
Wait a minute. So when you're in your 20s,
yeah,
you meet this Black Elk,
yep.
Wallace,
yep.
Black Elk.
Yeah.
And he refers to Jesus as the little hippie guy.
Yeah.
And he says, we knew him.
Yeah. So this is what he said. And, I mean, do bear in mind, you know, he spoke English a lot better than I speak Lakota. So, you know, it was just his little truncated way. It wasn't meant to be flippant, actually. But he said, and you get this, Kingsnorth talks about it a bit as well, my old pal Paul. You do get, in different cultures from all over the place, stories of characters that are very similar to Jesus. And he said, no, we always had a sense this fellow was around, and he was amongst us too. And so actually, there is something recognizable for us in the stories that the missionaries brought. And then he said something that haunted me for 25 years. He said, don't give up on him. He hasn't given up on you. And then that was it. And I, you know.
Talk about irony.
Yeah, yeah. But
the Lakota guy.
But of course, his granddad is a man called Nicholas Black Elk, who wrote Black Elk Speaks.
Holy cow.
Yeah, Catholic. So, wow. So it's funny how the world works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much. C.S. Lewis is so good about this, and that's why I love Lewis. But that he looks at the pagan world, the classical world. He doesn't reject it.
No.
He sees it as a prefiguring of anything that's good. It's pointed. That balance is difficult.
Yes, it is. For people. It's really difficult.
Because obviously, you know, and I know people in both camps, there's some people that would just absolutely reject that idea that anything that is not of the Bible is not Christian, anything that they just reject it, or reject the magic, or just reject it. But there are other people who open up to it so much that it becomes, in a way for me as a Christian, the Christian faith becomes so attenuated that nothing means anything. It doesn't matter if you worship Jesus. It's all good. Everything is good. And I would say, well, that's not right either. How do you balance that?
The book you have in your hands is my attempt to do that. And only you will know if I failed miserably or pulled something off. Because what I really don't want to do is put some sort of some spin on beautiful ancient stories that we actually live by. Like, I live with a mum and dad that, they're in my life. They're real worker bees for Jesus. Let me tell you about my mum. Let me tell you about my Auntie Jenny. When the clubs close in their little towns at 2 o'clock, there's lots of vulnerable young girls who come out of the club and they've had champagne and they've, you know, maybe they're a bit high, they've had some, and they're suddenly lost and vulnerable and there's lots of fellas around. And my Aunt Jenny cycles into town as an old woman with a flask of tea and sandwiches and biscuits, just in case one of these girls needs to have a chat. That's a beautiful thing. That's magnificent. And so that's the women in my family get up to that kind of stuff, you know.
And you're saying if she worshipped Hermes, she wouldn't be doing this? Just a simple shut up, Eric, will do.
I'm a fan of Hermes, actually.
Well,
Hermes, interesting. Now you've got me onto Hermes. The thing about Hermes, people say to me, aren't you pleased that we live in a Hermian age because of technology and everything moves so fast? And they think that's what Hermes likes. But here's the rub. Hermes can only communicate soul to soul. So if the soul is not roused, nothing has happened. So actually, this is a faux Hermian age. This is not the real thing. The real thing would actually be much slower. But I do think, to go back, it was good that you asked me that question, actually. No, I see compassion all over the place in all sorts of people all the time, and you'd have to be a nut bucket not to see that, to just put it in this particular place. However, I haven't got all of this figured out. And there are enormous bits of Christian theology that I find extremely strange. And I'm not sure if I've completely signed up for, but I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best. But the thing I'm trying to stay close to is the living fire of the stories, because that is the thing that I have to contribute to this conversation. I have luck in that way. So I can't talk. We were talking about... The trouble with people is you have a conversion experience and then you become an expert on church history. That's theory, dude.
Yeah.
That's not the thing itself. Yeah. So be careful.
Yeah.
Just be careful.
Right.
Watch it.
Right.
As Ian McGilchrist would say, you are now, it's a commentary from the left brain on the right brain, but you don't go to the right brain anymore. So try and avoid that. But there's a guy, have you ever interviewed Tom Wright? N.T. Wright, you know who he is?
Of course we do.
Of course you do. Okay, so here's a very...
And yes, I have.
So, I thought you would.
And he has a beard also.
He does, yeah. let's get past the beards and on to the thing I'd like to say about N.T. Wright, because he answers this, because he's a senior figure. N.T. Wright would say, just imagine... I won't do his voice. Just imagine you're on a train journey and you want to get... This is in my country. You want to get from Durham to Exeter. Now, for a lot of that journey, the land that you're going to go through, whether you're going to London or Exeter, it'll be very, very similar. It'll be the same issues and the same values. But at a certain point, if you want to go to Exeter, it veers off. And the views you experience and the things you encounter will become very distinct. And I think that is an incredible image of the Christian journey. And I'm sure a Hindu could say a similar thing. But I can't be massively universalist about all of this. People say to me recently, they said, you don't mean to tell me that you actually believe in the resurrection. Surely it's a glorious metaphor. And I say, well, it is a glorious metaphor, but I actually think it happened. The commotion in the Acts of the Apostles does not make me think that they're all working on fumes. You know, I think it was suitably strange. I think things were happening. But the reality is, in these wonderful stories, we're back to the river beneath the river, that on one level, there's a death and there's a resurrection, and that happens. But on another symbolic level, it has all of these other implications as well. And mercifully, we do not have to choose. We don't have to choose.
It is absolute torture to have to end this wonderful conversation. This is so rich and so joyful. I guess the good news is this doesn't have to end. It only has to end temporarily. I look forward to further conversations with you. Very grateful for the book. I will say that if you would like the author, Martin Shaw, to sign your copy, free copy, of the book, Martin will be seated here, or as they say in England, will be sat here to sign the book. And we have food and drink in the back.
If we could get some drink down this
until
end, that
yes,
would be great.
And until we've got somebody on that. So until they kick us out, we're free to hang out and talk and get to know each other. Let me say again, thank you for coming to Socrates in the City. We do this kind of thing not as often as I'd like, but as often as we can. And online, there are many of these kinds of conversations. And so that ends the official part of the evening, but not without my saying, how about a Socrates in the City thank you to Martin Shaw. If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.